Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, January 21st, 2022. I'm Brianne Doyle, the host of Rabble Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the stories that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or health, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week, we talk about why hazard pay isn't enough for our frontline workers in grocery stores. We'll also mark the passing of former NDP leader Alexa McDonough. Carl Nirenberg and Monia Mazik share their stories of Alexa. We'll discuss all of that and more a bit later on our show. First, Rabble contributor and former NDP deputy leader and House leader Libby Davies interviews political scientist Dr. Jeanette Ash. In part one of this special two-part series, Davies and Dr. Ash delve into the question of what a gender-sensitive parliament looks like. They take on topics of the gender-based heckling that takes place among elected representatives in our government and how COVID-19 has affected women in politics. Dr. Ash is the chair of the Political Science Department at Douglas College. She's also a visiting faculty member at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, King's College London. Her research interests include political recruitment, political parties, representation, and gender in politics. She is the author of Political Candidate Selection, Who Wins, Who Loses, and Underrepresentation in the UK. Other recent publications include Gender Sensitivity Under Trudeau, Facebook Feminism or Real Change, and Canada's Political Parties, Gatekeepers to Parliament. Dr. Ash advises legislatures, parties, and organizations on assessing gender and diversity sensitivity. She also advises legislators on drafting legislation on gender equity and democratic reform. Libby Davies is the author of Outside In, a political memoir. She served as the MP for Vancouver East from 1997 to 2015 and is former NDP deputy leader and House leader. Libby is also the recipient of the Order of Canada. Here are Libby and Jeanette in conversation in part one of our two-part special. Take a listen.
Hello, Jeanette. Welcome back. Last time we spoke on Rabble Radio, you shared great information about the issues and challenges women and other equity-seeking groups face in running for and being in political office. I'd like to continue our conversation today by hearing more about the research you have completed and the research that's still underway. I know you've looked at the BC legislature and how to make it gender sensitive. What does that mean, gender sensitive? And what did you recommend from the work that you did?
Thank you, Libby. It's really good to be back. A gender sensitive parliament, it's multifaceted, but some of the criteria include the following. A gender sensitive parliament is a place that promotes and achieves equality in the numbers of women and men across all of its bodies and internal structures. It mainstreams gender equality through all of its work. A gender sensitive parliament fosters an internal culture that respects women's rights and promotes gender equality. It is a place that respects the needs and realities for balance, work-life balance, family responsibilities for men and women. And a gender-sensitive parliament is one that extends beyond members. It also considers parliamentary staff, legislative staff, and equips them with the capacity and resources needed to promote gender equality. And this includes focusing on recruiting and also having retention of women in senior positions. And when I say women, I'm also including, you know, people who identify as women. So I'm considering intersectionality as well. So not just one kind of woman, but many, many types of women. So those are some of the criteria of a gender-sensitive parliament. And I should note that those criteria are from the Interparliamentary Union, which does a lot of work on gender-sensitizing parliaments. And there are actually more criteria. But these are just some. And I think before talking about the work I've done on BC, I want to just underscore that parliaments aren't places just for elected members where they go to debate and, you know, ask questions and pass legislation. These are workplaces, and they're workplaces for members, but also for many, many staff, so parliamentary, legislative staff, party staff. So when we're thinking of these places, we've got to think of them as places of work. And what should a place of work be like? What is a place of work that is gender sensitive and diversity sensitive? A place where people go and where they feel welcome, where they feel like they belong, where they feel safe, where they feel they can equally participate. I've done a little bit of work on this with the BC legislature initially. I've used the BC legislature as a case study, and it's the first of its kind in Canada. And I started to begin a gender and diversity assessment there. And there's many phases to a gender sensitive assessment. There's 7 steps. So I've started the first few steps in BC and published a report. It's online. It's called Assessing Gender and Diversity Sensitivity at the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia. And this report was prepared for the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians Canadian region. So you can find that online, and you can find more details about what a gender-sensitive parliament is, what it looks like, and some of my initial findings. So one of the steps of a gender-sensitive parliament that I did do in BC is to get the clerk's office to fill out a checklist to determine how ready a parliament, a legislature, is to undertake a gender-sensitive assessment, because it is a big undertaking. And so you have to find out just if they have the kind of data that are required to do a gender-sensitive assessment. And if you go to the report that you can find online, you'll see that there's 68 initial questions that were filled in by the clerk's office. And of those 68 questions, they only were collecting data on 11 of the kinds of things that you needed data on. That's not to be discouraging. It's just to show how much a fulsome gender-sensitive assessment is needed. So they don't really collect data on things like representation on committees, or there's no requirement, for example, for the legislature to debate the importance of gender diversity at all. So there's a lot of room for improvement. Now, I should say that BC comparatively isn't doing badly. I mean, 43% of the legislators in BC are women. There's one party, the BC NDP, that has over 50% women in its caucus. It's a very diverse legislature, more diverse than it's ever been. The head clerk is a woman, Kate Ryan Lloyd. The speaker, Raj Johan, for example, is from an equity deserving group. And so there's been lots of steps towards gender sensitivity. They're undertaking a workplace review. But again, there's a lot of room for improvement. I've been undertaking ongoing interviews with the staff and members there as the second part of my gender sensitive review of the legislature. And I'm hearing a lot of things that reflect what members of other legislatures are saying, just like the heckling is a problem. A lot of women feel that they don't really belong there. They don't feel welcome. And when we think about people, when they get elected to a place, we have to consider what happens to them. So a lot of women are reporting that they're not getting promoted at the same rates as men. But again, you know, we need the data, the diversity data on this as well. Some women are reporting that they don't feel safe in other places. Some report that the rules are really archaic and old, and they reflect the legislature as it was when it was built. It was a place that was built by men, for men. And not a lot of the institutional features of the place have changed. So it's still very much like a masculine place with a masculine culture. And, you know, this is kind of embedded in its practices and its rules. So when we talk about a gender-sensitive parliament, we have to talk about identifying what those gender-insensitive rules are, those gender-insensitive practices are, the sort of masculine cultural features of it. And we've got to change those, and we have to institutionalize those changes. So it's not just about informally doing things differently. It's about implementing these changes. And it shouldn't be done just by a few champions of gender diversity. So it's not the responsibility of, you know, the parliamentary secretary, who is amazing, Grace Lohr, for gender equity. It's the responsibility of everybody there. It's not the responsibility of a handful of women in the Women's Caucus. It's the responsibility of all members and staff and parliament or the legislatures itself. Like, it has to be institutionally changed.
That's really a lot of detailed information that tells us how complex this work is. So I'd like to move beyond the BC legislature, which, as you said, was a case study. And because I know you're also doing work at the national level, including you've done interview surveys with MPs and staff. What have you learned from that at the national level? Is it similar to the BC situation or is it different? And particularly the issue of the hybrid parliament that we've seen in the last couple of years.
So the case study of the BC legislature, that kind of paved way for doing a larger assessment, a more fulsome assessment through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. And I've been asked now to look at the national legislature, so the House of Commons and the Senate, and parliaments, legislatures across Canada, so in other jurisdictions. And this also includes the BC legislature as well. So I'm undertaking the next steps of the BC legislature gender sensitivity parliamentary review. And in addition to BC, I'm focusing on Manitoba and Quebec and Prince Edward Island. And as I said, the National House of Commons and the Senate. So this is a more fulsome review. It is looking at many steps of the gender sensitive review process. I'm finding some very interesting things. This is ongoing, this work. So I'm interviewing members of parliament and members of different provincial legislative assemblies. And there's also a survey that's being sent out to members of the House of Commons and the Senate, as well as the provincial legislatures. I'm getting responses now. Some of the feedback that I've been getting amongst women anyways, is the impact that things like heckling, so verbal harassment, it has on them. This is something that I'm seeing in all the legislatures, different jurisdictions. It's just the impact that heckling's having upon them. It's really upsetting. And this idea that if they complain about it, or if they say, hey, this heckling doesn't feel right or it's upsetting, they're told, you know, to toughen up, that this is part of politics and this is what they should expect. But this is the very thing that indicates a parliament is not a gender sensitive place. So to be told that heckling is a part of it, to expect heckling and not to complain about heckling, is something that reinforces this really sort of toxic masculine culture in parliament. One of the things that is coming through in the surveys and the interviews that I ask about is the experiences with hybridity. So one of the things that have come out of the pandemic is parliaments across the world, including Canada, they've been disrupted. So the workplace has been disrupted, like all of our workplaces, and they've had to adapt. And one of the ways that adaptation has taken place is to move parliament online. So this allows members to participate virtually from home in terms of recorded divisions and also committee work. And there's been varied responses to this. So at the national level, they passed a bill in the fall that is allowing members of parliament to engage with hybridity so they can work from home in terms of recorded divisions or committee work, or they can work face to face. It's up to them. And I think that's in place until spring 2022 and it'll be revisited. Some of the provincial legislatures have also engaged with hybridity, not all of them. Some of them have, BC has as well. But what we've seen happening provincially is that it hasn't been continued. So members can still participate virtually, but they have to have a reason. They have to be ill. Otherwise, they're expected to be there. Now, nationally and in the provinces, what I've been finding is there's this real nervousness about, well, what if we'll always have to be face-to-face? And when people have experienced this staying at home and being able to vote, it's allowed them to more fully participate. And I see this especially with women and people with members with young children, staff as well, saying that the ability to vote from home, especially when they're caring for elders or for people who are ill in their family or children, for example, has allowed them to more fulsomely participate. They can vote. And there's, again, this real worry that if it's mandated that they have to go face-to-face sort of permanently, that they might not reoffer themselves. So they might not seek re-election. And this is the problem, because we have already a problem in terms of retention of women members. We see higher turnover of women members. So if we've come up with a solution to make a parliament more gender sensitive and the technology is already there, so hybridity, why not keep it if it makes the place more gender sensitive? If it makes the workplace a place where, you know, all members can more fully participate, and if it means that people are going to stay in their job, then this is kind of a win-win situation. I want to say, though, it's not the same for all. Some people don't like it. They like the energy of being face-to-face. And one thing to consider, too, is the impact it has on staff. Again, some staff like it because, again, they can participate more fully if they have other responsibilities. But some staff have said that it's actually made their workload a lot more. Hearing from staff, they say, you know, our expectation is expected that we are there to serve the members. And the member's lifestyle. But when we change the institution, it doesn't always benefit us, right? So we might be stuck inside and not able to do the work from home, but we're expected to, extend our hours to allow for this virtual online experience for members where it doesn't actually benefit us. Another aspect, though, of the hybrid parliament is that I've been hearing from especially women members, especially younger women members and women members who identify as Indigenous or Black as a person of color, that it has made the experience of being a legislator safer. It's made them feel more comfortable. And one reason for this is that there is no heckling. If another member is heckling them, then they can be muted. And members are generally muted unless they're, you know, talking. So the experience of heckling has gone way down. And it's made working more pleasant. And when you think about these places as workplaces, in what other workplace is it okay to scream at your colleagues and to call them names or to undermine them? And a lot of this is really gender-based, right? And despite legislatures trying to improve upon their codes of conduct, there's still a lot of gaps there. I've been talking to a lot of members who say that they like that there's no heckling anymore, that they feel safer. There's also of course, there's no instances of face-to-face intimidation or other forms of harassment that we see, of course, happening across jurisdictions. And it's a real thing. I mean, Me Too has come to parliaments across Canada for sure. And more people are researching violence against women in politics. And in all of the interviews I've done with women, all of them have shared incidences of harassment in one way or another that they've received from other members of their legislative assemblies or members of parliament who harass them, who intimidate them, who bully them. Again, a lot of this is gender-based. It's not right. It shouldn't be taking place, but it does. The way to follow up on this is problematic as well. So the harassment codes of conduct and harassment policies across Canada need to still be improved.
That is an incredibly significant finding that you've come across with the hybrid parliament and the responses that you got, which leads me to my last question, really, and that is how important this research is so that we actually can get the data, get the experiences, both the objective and the subjective experiences. So how much of this work is being undertaken elsewhere? Are you on your own doing this work, or are there other parliaments in other countries looking at this kind of issue as well?
I am far from alone, and all of the work I do on this, I'm building on the work of other gender and politics scholars and researchers and other organizations. And if it wasn't for the work that they've done already and that they are doing, I wouldn't be doing this work at all. This work is very, very much inspired by the work of Professor Sarah Childs, who did the real first fulsome gender sensitive assessment of the British Parliament. She did that in 2016, and you can go online and see it. It's called The Good Parliament. It's amazing. So my work very, very much builds on Sarah Child's work. And she has been incredibly supportive in the work that I've been doing in Canada and has been sort of a champion of this work and has encouraged it from the get-go. This work also builds on the work of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association and Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians, who have been doing work on women's political equality in Commonwealth countries for over 20 years. And it also builds on the work of the Interparliamentary Union, who have been doing this work for over a decade as well, and has put together a gender assessment toolkit. So you can go online and see the Interparliamentary Union's gender assessment toolkit. And this is the toolkit that the IPU encourages all parliaments to look at. And they really encourage all parliaments to undertake an internal gender parliamentary assessment review. So it's something that's really widely available. And you can see there the list of countries that have done it. Right now, I am doing some more work for the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. And they have asked me to do a field guide, so a gender sensitive parliamentary field guide. And I'm just completing that right now. And the gender Sensitive Parliamentary Field Guide, 7 steps to a gender sensitive parliament. So I've come up with the 7 steps to a gender sensitive assessment of a parliament. This is a field guide that all Commonwealth parliaments will be encouraged to look at, and it should be coming out soon.
That is fantastic to hear. I mean, there's just so much work that you've undertaken. And I get the sense that you are optimistic that there will be follow-up, that your work has been received very well, because of course it's resonating with the experience that all of these equity-seeking groups have. So it sounds like you're optimistic that there will be follow-up.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the gender sensitizing parliaments undertaking assessment, or at least talking about an assessment, is becoming more of a norm now, an international norm. So it would be more odd not to be talking about this at this point. And parliaments look at what other parliaments are doing. And so one of the measures of a gender sensitive parliament is having equal numbers of women and men in legislative bodies, and also within staff, within senior positions as well. So a lot of parliaments are looking at how they can work toward this. Parliaments, again, looking to see what other parliaments are doing, or are noticing, okay, well, one way to make our workplace more gender sensitive is to think about changing some of the rules about how we undertake our, you know, everyday business. And one of those things would be proxy voting. And what we saw come out of Sarah Child's The Good Parliament, she came up with 43 recommendations of how to make the good parliament more gender sensitive. And I should say, a really important part of gender sensitizing the parliament is to institutionalize the gender sensitivity recommendations. And this is done by assigning any recommendation to a particular person, like, for example, to a speaker. And the speaker has a good deal of authority in terms of implementing gender sensitivity recommendations. So one of the things that came out of Sarah Child's Good Parliament is proxy voting. And proxy voting is now being trialed in the UK, and it's very, very welcome indeed. We've seen there instances where women members, you have to be present for recorded divisions, for example. So a woman member of parliament was scheduled to have a C-section, and she had to be present for the recorded division. I mean, there's no ifs and or buts, and she had to be there. It was a very close vote. And so she showed up for the recorded division in a wheelchair, about to have a C-section, just so she could vote. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So shortly after that, and with a lot of pressure, and this is one of many, many instances, with a lot of pressure, the British Parliament is now trialing proxy voting. So you don't have to be physically present to cast your vote. You can get somebody to act as a proxy for you. And so this, of course, has caught wind across other jurisdictions. And now Canada's national parliament is looking into proxy voting and other kinds of policy changes, small policy changes that would make a huge difference. I mean, so you don't have women showing up to vote just moments away of having a C-section and having to postpone that C-section of all things. So small things like that. There's quite a few examples, but that's one. And I think that we'll see more parliaments revisiting or looking at this in more detail.
Well, that's a very dramatic example and a very good example of why things need to change. Jeanette, we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you so much. I know we have a lot more to talk about. And in fact, we are going to do a follow-up segment of our conversation that's going to look at the role and what political parties can do. We've talked about what a gender-sensitive parliament looks like, the research you've done, what parliaments need to do, but I think what political parties need to do is very important too. So we're going to follow that up in our next conversation. So again, thank you so much for all the information that you shared today.
Okay, thank you, Libby. And I should just say, I feel like I should be interviewing you about this.
It's a good conversation.
You were there.
It's a good conversation.
Yeah. All right, thank you. We'll talk again soon.
That was Dr. Jeanette Ash in conversation with Libby Davies. Join us again next week when we'll hear part 2 of that conversation. Thanks for that, Dr. Ash and Libby. Looking forward to it. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. This week, Rabble remembers Alexa McDonough, McDonough was Canada's first woman to lead a major political party when she was elected the Nova Scotia New Democrat in 1980. She passed away on Saturday, January 15, 2022, at the age of 77. Monia Mazik was a close friend of McDonough. In her recent column, she recalls how Alexa McDonough stood by her when her husband, Mahir Arar, was held in U.S. custody for 2 weeks after a family vacation in Tunis. Mazik recalls McDonough standing against injustice when the Canadian government became complicit with the American authorities. The Americans had rendered her husband to Syria, a country he had not called home since he was 17 years old. Mazik writes, "Alexa was not intimidated by the whispers that warned her my husband was a hot potato. She stood with me and remained faithful to her principles of social justice and human rights. In 2003, my husband came home after spending more than a year in prison where he was never charged with any crime and endured torture. Upon his return, Alexa continued to be a pillar in our road towards justice." Carl Nirenberg shares a history of some of the highs and lows of McDonough's political career. He praises her as single-handedly rebuilding the NDP's presence in the Maritimes. There, she established the party as a force for social justice and positive change on the national scene. That paved the way for her NDP successor, Jack Layton. Nirenberg observes, "Keeping the movement alive and relevant during its darkest hour might indeed be Alexa's greatest legacy." Also on the site this week, Stephen Wenzel criticizes grocery store CEOs reaping record profits while their grocery store workers remain among the lowest paid workers in Canada. Grocery chains in our country instituted hazard pay for a brief moment at the outset of the pandemic 2 years ago, but now workers are back to unsafe conditions, minimum wage, and often with little to no paid sick leave. Wenzel writes that even with a so-called hazard pay increase, it still leaves many low-income Canadians far from a livable wage. Lisa Cameron, writer and organizer with the Halifax Workers Action Center, tells Rabble that workers have devoted themselves tirelessly to their frontline work while being both underpaid and underappreciated. Major grocery chains should recognize the risks undertaken by their employees and compensate them accordingly, Cameron says. Even if the grocery chains reintroduce hazard pay for their employees, the fact remains that a minimum wage is too low across the country. Cameron adds that governments can't keep trusting employees to do the right thing when it comes to paid sick days, livable wages, and access to health and dental coverage. These aren't decisions we ought to leave in the hands of employers. These are decisions that ought to be determined by law, Cameron says. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. If you like the show, please consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Libby Davies and Dr. Jeanette Ash for their interview this week. Thanks also to Stephen Wenzel and Carl Nirenberg for their reporting, and Carl, too, for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.